You're listening to World Affairs. I'm Philip Yun. So, in addition to severely complicating the challenges faced by a new Biden administration abroad, Trump is also stoking controversy at home.
This morning, President Trump is intensifying his efforts to overturn the results of the election he lost. President Trump, in an extraordinary move, is set to host Republican state lawmakers from Michigan that he invited to the White House. The Trump campaign is focused on Michigan as it seeks to stop the state from certifying the count, where Biden leads by more than 150,000 votes.
And his disinformation campaign is gaining strength, undermining democratic institutions across the country.
Donald Trump launching an assault on the integrity of the election, unleashing a barrage of false claims of fraud and corruption without evidence.
In your view, Mr. President-elect, what do you think the president is doing? What are Americans witnessing here?
I think they're witnessing incredible irresponsibility, incredibly damaging messages being sent to the rest of the world about how democracy functions.
Officials in some swing states are getting threats from Trump's supporters. And to the distress of many, 70% of Republican voters don't think this election was free and fair. There are a lot of reasons why Trump's deception and propaganda efforts are so effective, and an unchecked digital media landscape is part of the problem. When we first heard about the World Wide Web in the 1990s, it was sold as an information superhighway, something that could democratize the world. The potential was, and still is, tremendous. But it's not the utopian ideal many envisioned. As 2020 has made clear, more information doesn't always mean more facts or more accuracy. The break-all-the-rules approach of pseudo-news sites and the unfettered use of social media leaves us confused about what's real and what's manufactured, so much so that producers of a children's TV program are waving a warning flag.
Buster, how do you know if any of this stuff is true?
What do you mean?
How do you know someone didn't just make it up?
What? You mean just lie? You really think someone would do that? Just go on the internet and tell lies?
I just mean that some of the details...
Whoa, I never thought of that. This is terrible. What if none of it's true? What if they're all lying?
Claire Bond Potter says the internet's unregulated freedom and its economic incentives have taken us down some roads we really don't want to be on. She teaches history at the New School for Social Research in New York. Her newest book is Political Junkies, From Talk Radio to Twitter, How Alternative Media Hooked Us on Politics and Broke Our Democracy. She spoke with KQED's Rachel Miro before a live stream audience in October.
Claire, I thought I'd begin reading this line that you wrote in Political Junkies. Although we consume news all day on our digital devices, the vast majority of Americans are more alienated from each other and from a political system that requires citizen participation to function than they've ever been. I know this is a tough one to lob out at the beginning of the conversation, but what is the end game? Do you think we're headed for civil war?
Well, I hope we're not headed for civil war. And I think part of what social media has allowed actually is a kind of catastrophizing about the election. You know, as soon as someone says civil war, then it gets tweeted and it's out all over the place. If it's someone really important who said it, we find articles about it in Breitbart and the New York Post and perhaps even Politico and some of the ones you and I read. I do think that what is most troubling about what we used to call the filter bubbles is the absolute refusal of many people to believe things that are true. And I think this is less likely among liberals than it is among conservatives. I think there's an extreme right that is refusing all knowledge that comes from what they perceive as elites, whether it's political elites or financial elites or media elites. But within that, it's almost impossible to have a conversation in which people modify their views by exchanging information and educating each other. That is, after all, what a conversation is. And back in the day, when blogging was the king of the hill, blogging was actually a great medium for exchanging information. The combination of the blog roles, in which bloggers sort of checked on each other all the time and linked back to each other, but the comments section, in which commenters would weigh in and do their own research and bring that research to the table. Now we are mostly not exchanging research and knowledge. We're exchanging opinions.
Claire, I guess I would ask, you know, sometimes I feel like, you know, academics and liberal media pundits can be accused of a kind of both sidesism. As you mentioned, you're more likely, if you lean right, to question basic facts. And what kind of meaningful conversation that includes genuine listening can you have with somebody who refuses to acknowledge basic facts? You know, climate change is real. COVID-19 is a thing that is happening. It's not a democratically organized conspiracy.
It is difficult. And I think one of the outlets that is most to blame, although not the only one, is Fox News.
Good evening and welcome to Tucker Carlson Tonight. Thank you for watching. We appreciate it. In case you haven't noticed, it's hard to trust anything you hear right now.
And when I was writing this book, my sister-in-law was in the hospital in New York and was sharing a room with someone. And so we were the MSNBC family, and the family next to us was the Fox family. And at one point, all of my relatives were out of the room. My sister-in-law was sleeping. And I listened to a conversation that people were having next door about the Constitution. And they really got some fundamental things wrong about the Constitution. So I'm a history teacher. So I just kind of leaned around the corner and said, you know, I just have to tell you the Establishment Clause, blah, 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 blah. And they were like, really? And so we had a long conversation about the Constitution in which they were very receptive to that information. What was striking to me is they listened to Fox News all the time and they didn't know anything. So I think where we can actually sort of look at the ways in which liberals and some conservatives part ways, it is that when you're locked into outlets that are dedicated to not actually giving you real information or factual information, but exert a strong emotional pull, that means that in order to actually admit that your worldview is wrong, you have to separate from the sources that give you the most pleasure. And if I think of the ways in which we were chatting a little bit beforehand about the PBS NewsHour, I've always felt since I was a child that all the people on the PBS NewsHour were my friend. You know, if I found out that they were giving me false information, it would be heartbreaking. And I think as a writer, part of what I try to do is not make excuses for that worldview, but to have enough empathy for it to try to understand why people are responding the way they are. Because, you know, many of these people, they're not stupid, they're not uneducated, and yet the emotional pull of Trumpism is so profound that to admit that there's a little chink in the armor risks the whole thing unraveling. I would liken it to some of the ways people have described leaving a cult, that, you know, once you find out that one thing they told you wasn't true, then you think, well, what else isn't true? And you start to pick it apart. That's what it would entail to bring conservatives back into a conversation, I think.
I was taken in your book where you talk about the impact of the Vietnam War on the way first, I guess you could say, the American left and then the media and then finally the right lost a sense of trust in what our government leaders are telling us about what's happening and why.
I think the Vietnam War is an incredibly important turning point for two reasons. One is because people on the left don't trust the media, they begin to proliferate all of these other outlets. And I think one of the things that's important to say about the 1960s is that journalists themselves were deeply and profoundly frustrated by what they were allowed to say about the war. And I talk about this a little bit in the second chapter, which is about Robert McNeil and the founding of the PBS NewsHour. And McNeil, of course, would get these rushes every day. It was when he was working for NBC, and he would get these rushes flown in from Vietnam. And he and the other editors would see the most horrific things. And then they would kind of look at each other and say, well, you know, we can't show that during dinner time. But they were all deeply troubled by how much they came to believe they were putting together a movie about a war and not reporting on the war. And they became very deeply troubled by the fact that they had colleagues in Vietnam who were risking their lives to get those stories, and they weren't getting on the air.
I'm consistently taken with how even thinking adults have such trouble identifying, you know, guessing at the truthiness of a presentation. And certainly there's a lot of cultural appeal to the packaging of news, or we wouldn't see commentators presenting themselves as news presenters. But mainstream media has totally lost whatever control it had as a gatekeeper. So you go onto Twitter and you see the crowdsourcing, not just of opinions about news or opinions about other people's coverage of the news, but people trying to present the news as if they were the arbiters of truth.
Well, of course, that's the case. And the only thing I would say about gatekeeping is there was this moment in which gatekeeping was revealed as a problem. And that was the early 2000s, as bloggers began to capture their audiences. And many of these people were amateur journalists. Some of them were bankers and lawyers who would write their blogs in their spare time. In 2006, George Allen Jr. is in a park in Virginia and points at a guy who's a tracker for the other campaign, who's South Asian, and says, let's give a big welcome to Makaka here.
This fella here over here with the yellow shirt, Makaka, or whatever his name is, he's with my opponent. He's following us around everywhere.
And it's all being caught on tape. And George Allen had been saying racist things for 15 years. He had been in a fraternity that had Confederate flags all over. No one would report it. And it wasn't just the local Richmond papers. It was the Washington Post. It was the New York Times. No one would tell these stories. There was a kind of gentleman's agreement not to do that. So when he says this thing to the tracker, who gets it on tape, the tracker uploads it to YouTube. Josh Marshall uploads it to Talking Points Memo, and all of a sudden, it's a conversation. George Allen really is a racist, right? And so bloggers were able to push stories back into the news that journalists and, you know, probably more likely their editors did not want to cover. And, you know, it's not that this was cynical. I mean, I.F. Stone talked about this in the 1950s, about how proud he was to be independent, because he said newspapers not only were governed by their advertisers, who would say, you can't run that story about cigarettes because we sell cigarettes, but they were also, they had deals with politicians. They had friendships with politicians. They relied on inside information to actually get good stories and get out there ahead of their competition and so on. So that when bloggers enter the scene and say, we're not going to let you do that anymore, there is a moment in which saying, okay, gatekeeping has been the problem with politics. And now that we don't have gatekeepers anymore, everything's going to be okay. And of course, it didn't work out that way.
But of course, now we don't have accountability for truth telling. Do you believe that social media exacerbates polarization? If so, what are the solutions to this polarization?
Well, I do believe social media exacerbates polarization. And I think there are two pieces of it. One is that Facebook and Twitter are corporations that are dedicated to making money and only making money. And that actually makes them different from other media outlets who have an interest in the integrity of the product. There is no integrity to a product in Facebook or Twitter because the users are the product, right? And what they're making money on is advertising and data. They're not making money on the information. So it honestly doesn't matter what information is swirling around these companies. And it allows very damaging information to continue to exist because it makes money. Conspiracy theories make money for people. And so that's really important to remember. And the more extreme the views on social media, the more clicks they're going to get and the more money they make for these companies. So this is in part a business plan being enacted. It's not a commitment to democracy. It's not a commitment to conversation. What social media companies know is that rage and all the other dark emotions are actually better clickbait than kittens and puppies and anything happy. So that I would say social media is exacerbating this both because until very, very recently, they've been willing to do anything to keep making money, and also because they're engineered to be divisive. They're engineered to make us argue. So what we see are things that are likely to agitate us and keep us on the platform. Now, let me also say that social media had that little window where it looked like it was going to be good for democracy. The Howard Dean campaign started using blogs and texting and email, and they were really the first campaign to figure out how to put together a grassroots coalition using digital platforms.
Good evening, and thanks for coming to another Dean meetup. First, I want to thank you all for what you've done. Last January, our campaign was an asterisk in the polls. We had $127,000 in the bank, 427 supporters on Meetup, and a staff small enough to fit into a single room.
I mean, they didn't invent it. They noticed that other people were doing it. Meetup.com. Joe Trippi, the political consultant, has this great moment where he starts looking at these meetups and realizing that there were groups of people all over the country that were not on the map of the campaign who were raising money for Howard Dean because they liked him so much. So there is this little window, and obviously Obama uses social media very, very effectively to create communities and connect to people. In the chapter I researched about the Tea Party, one of the things that was really interesting was to see that all of these people migrated out of the Ron Paul campaign and some of them out of the Howard Dean campaign and used those social media skills to establish the Tea Party, which had nothing to do with electoral politics initially. It was about protest and it was about being seen and being heard on a set of issues that they didn't feel were being represented in public.
Hey, why do you like Ron Paul?
Well, you know, it's the first time in years I got involved in this. I started seeing other people, and I started watching this thing, and this is what he stands for, the same thing I believe in, totally. You know, the freedom, the monetary system, bring us back to the gold standard, all the things he's for, I'm for.
And so they were extremely conscious about their social media use before Fox jumped in and then pumped it up into a national movement and Dick Armey and all of those folks. There was a real grassroots network of libertarian conservatives who were genuinely exchanging ideas on these platforms. But one of the features of social media that everyone understands by 2008 is that it is about you. So that all social media, if it doesn't actually speak to you, it's not going to work. And what that does is it causes social media companies to write these algorithms that use our data to figure out what is going to juice us up, what is going to keep us in the conversation, what is going to make us angry. So that's why we get this stuff. And I think one of the things people have to think about really hard is not whether they want to be on social media, but what they want to use social media for. It's not the place to have important intellectual or political conversations because invariably they go awry.
So I guess this brings us back to the media. Is it even possible for professional journalists to re-engage with this public conversation in the United States? And if so, how?
Well, that's a really good question. And I think if I were a journalist right now, I would be very worried because the financial structure of journalism is bad. I mean, there were really bad layoffs right before the pandemic. It's possible that journalism is one of those professions that the pandemic has actually helped. There is now among some media watchers the idea that we've actually left Web 2.0 and we're now in Web 3.0, where people don't read or listen to anything that isn't delivered directly to them. So we have podcasts that automatically download on our devices. We have newsletters that automatically come to our email. We have apps on our phones so that we can read the New York Times on the bus and so on. So I think journalists have to work hard to be heard and to be read. And what that means, and I think this has been happening since the early 2000s, is actually editors and publishers have less time to spend on content and they have less money to spend on content. So that, I think, is the big problem. And, you know, I'm not a huge Amazon fan, but let me say, when Jeff Bezos bought the Washington Post and the first thing he did was hire 60 international reporters, I thought, that's the model.
The company has been losing readers and revenue, down by 44%. So now comes Bezos with his deep pockets. He'll pay $250 million for the Post and other papers. That's less than 1% of his net worth.
You know, we need billionaires, or better yet, unions, to actually invest in newspapers. And we need to admit that, like education, newspapers will never make money for people, but that they are actually integral to our democracy.
You know, I often have a conversation with people who complain about particular news organizations. They'll say, oh, you know, I hate the Washington Post, or I hate the Wall Street Journal because, you know, I read X, or they covered Y story really, really badly. But what I don't hear people saying to me is that they treat these organizations as teams of reporters. Some of them are going to be better than others. Some of them are going to have bad days. Others are going to have good days. Maybe you like a certain kind of coverage, what's happening in the White House from one news organization, but you go to another to find out what's happening in the Middle East or in Japan. But I don't think people see it this way. Maybe they really are, like you said earlier, just responding to who's ever pinging most loudly on their phones.
One of the things that I've observed over time is that we have become more reactive than ever. And in the early days of the blogosphere, that reactivity was fun. You would read something, you would have a response to it, you would write a blog post, you would put it up, other people would respond to it all day, and there was this kind of zingy feeling to it. Nowadays, particularly since we're carrying around these apps on our phones, the reactivity is overriding a lot of thinking, right? And we have come to characterize everybody and every institution by the thing that they have done lately that has come to our attention. And I think it makes it difficult for journalists to be heard because very often people only make it through the first half of the podcast or the first three paragraphs of what you've written, and they're on to something else, but boy, do they have an opinion about it. And part of that, I think, is absolutely being driven by our obsession with having something to say on social media all the time.
So now this challenge from Frank, this is depressing. Please provide hope for the future and steps to achieve it.
Okay, hope for the future. Ezra Klein's Why We're Polarized is a great book to read because he not only talks about why we're polarized, but talking about that and gives us a map for how not to be. You asked me, Rachel, you know, is there going to be a civil war? No, I really don't think there is. But I think the more we talk about it and the more anxious people are, the more likely there is that there will be incidents that are violent and deeply regrettable and sad because various people have taken it into their own hands to do what they think they need to do to defend Donald Trump or defend their own interests and so on. I think we're entering into a very dangerous stage, and one in which white supremacists and militia members in particular seem to be doing a very, very good job of organizing themselves and calling out these sort of lightning strikes through social media. I'm not sure that social media is prepared to deal with that, but they need to be, and they need to be able to face the world they have created honestly in order to fix it. I believe they can, but they have to start by admitting that there's a problem, and the problem is them. Honestly, I think this is something that a good Department of Justice should look at, because I think there are a couple of things to think about. One is free speech is not unlimited. Much as many of our friends on the right would like to say it is unlimited, it is not unlimited. And there are a variety of things that are happening on social media now that do not fall under the right to free speech, that constitute fighting words, that constitute shouting fire in a theater. I really think we have to get some good First Amendment brains on this and say, if we were to regulate social media, and I think we should regulate social media, there are a variety of reasons we don't, most prominently the 1996 Telecommunications Act, which, you know, that was sort of at the dawn of the internet. Everyone was like, oh no, there shouldn't be any limits, because if there are limits, then we might miss the next brilliant thing, right? So we have been bound by that ever since. And in the 1996 Telecommunications Act, also these companies cannot be sued for content that they're carrying. And that really has to change. That has to change for a variety of reasons, only one of which is political. Revenge porn is another one. But they can't be sued. So I really think regulating the internet is something we need to think hard about.
Alyssa says, Biden is for your generation. Why don't politicians pay attention to the largest generation to have ever existed? We have no faith in your system. You can blame social media, or you can look at yourselves and your active denial of the lives millennials live.
So, Alyssa, I am sympathetic. I have not always been 62. And I think one of the things I would point you to is how much, and this is one of the good things about social media, how much progressives have used social media to organize and elect people. And some of the most interesting politics right now is going on at the grassroots level. I would say if you're not so angry that you just want to sit home and forget the whole thing, you should join Democratic Socialists of America and you should get involved with them. They've got some of the best boots on the ground organization that I know, electing people to city council, electing people to state legislature. And I think one of the things, and I suppose I will cop to it, it's my generation. One of the big mistakes for Democrats in particular has been focusing on national elections, when in fact most of the action and certainly most of the opportunity for Democratic participation and input is at the very local level. And I think there's sort of two things that are really responsible for this. One is the death of local journalism. A lot of people have no idea who is actually running for city council in their neighborhood. They have no idea who's on the school board. They have no idea what the school board does because they don't have a newspaper that has a reporter that is covering it. I mean, for example, right now, look at the millions of parents who are so deeply and profoundly distressed about the fact that our school systems have been running on empty and now they're breaking in relation to COVID-19. Why is that? Well, big part of that has to do with not funding public education. The big part of that has to do with the fact that we're willing to put 40 kids in the classroom in a good school, right? So that's not something that happens at the federal level. That is something that happens at the level of your city and the level of your state. Republicans knew that. Back in the 1960s, Phyllis Schlafly, one of my favorite conservatives ever, said the most important election you will ever vote in is your vote that you cast for the school board, right? And if you look at how a lot of people who are now in their 70s, a lot of women who are now in their 70s got into politics, it's often they were organizing to get a stop sign in their neighborhood. There was a seat vacant on the school board and no one to run. And someone said, how about you? So, you know, a lot of women have started at the local level. I would also just say, it's not just that we need more candidates. Part of what's wrong with the alienation from the system as a whole is that there are people like Ocasio-Cortez who are ready to do the work. I mean, she had no experience in politics whatsoever, and she is competing at a major league level in Congress. So I would say it's not the system, it is how we understand the system and where we think our influence should be exercised.
Well, that seems like a great note to end on. And I thank you all for joining me in this conversation with Claire. Urge you to read her book, because is it timely.
Thank you so much, Rachel.
Thank you.
You've been listening to World Affairs. We just heard Claire Bond Potter talking with KQED's Rachel Miro. If you want to hear this program or any other episode, you can download our podcast at worldaffairs.org. While you're there, please consider making a donation to support the program you value. World Affairs is produced in partnership with KQED, with funding from First Republic Bank, Chevron, Dentons, Asset Management Company, and Jonathan and Marit Visbal. This episode was produced by Joanne Jennings, Teresa Katsarilis, Andrew Stelzer, and Jared Sport. Temba Daniels provided research assistance. Our technical supervisor is Jim Bennett. Our music is from Blue Dot Sessions. I'm Philip Yun. Thank you for listening.